Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte, episode 65 for April 18th, 2009. Ubuntu Community Manager John O'Bacon. Floss Weekly is brought to you by the 2009 Google Summer of Code Project. Google has posted ideas from participating 2009 mentor organizations. Review the ideas and get involved in the open source community at code.google.com/SOC. Don't forget to tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free, Libre, open source software each and every week. Our host, ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, Randall Schwartz. Come on down! I'm just trying.
Now you're going to have to cue the music for me coming down. Thanks, Leo. Hey, good to talk to you again. And I will disagree. I'm not the star of the show. The star of the show are the people we bring on that are doing all the wonderful projects that we get to talk to, the people that are involved with all those projects.
Well, you could say that for sure this week, because I have been informed that a rock star will be joining us. Literally.
Literally a rock star. I have been looking forward to the show for a really long time. We have coming up on this show none other than the one and only John O'Bacon. Yes, indeed, Floss with Bacon this week. So that is not a command. That is a declarative statement.
Although, mighty tasty. I don't know how good it is for your dental health, but mighty tasty. Severedhead.com.
He's no Jeff Robbins. Let's just say that.
Severed Fifth. Hey, Jeff had a career as a musician.
Yeah, but not a metal musician. So I'm just saying it's a little bit noisier. So yes, it's going to be really good to talk with John. He's done so many different things. I met him at Scale, the Southern California Linux Expo, a few weeks back, and he was a really strong performer on stage, talking about specifically the thing I think we're going to get to mostly in our conversation with him today, which is about his role as the Ubuntu community manager. So his job is to develop the relationship between the developers amongst themselves and also the developers and the end user community, and just kind of like all that support stuff. This is the kind of thing that a marketing group would do for, say, a proprietary company. This is sort of that equivalent role for an open source community.
You know, when you look at Mozilla, you look at Ubuntu, these are two really good examples of brilliantly marketed products.
Absolutely.
And it just shows, you know, a lot of times I think people think, oh, open source, you know, it's just a bunch of hippies and anti-capitalists. But really, open source can be very vital, very viable. And because the community is so involved in the creation of the software and you know, kind of the direction of the software, boy, this is a natural for kind of the new style of marketing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, as we've seen over and over again in these shows, in the 64 shows that we've done together through the beginning of the series.
But who's counting?
But who's counting, right. It's a nice power of two. That was a good milestone.
That's good, yeah.
As we've seen over and over again, really, the only thing different about open source, sort of the first general cut, is that you get the source code so you can play with it and build on it. But everything else still has to be there. If you want to make a business out of it, if you want to reach the most number of people, you're going to have a semi-professional marketing organization, management, coordination of various kinds, release schedules, so on. I mean, you know, companies like Canonical with Ubuntu and Red Hat producing Red Hat Linux, things like that, have had to be seriously in business. They've had to do all the normal serious things that it would take to do community support and things like that. Now, what's different about open source is that a lot of the traditionally in-house support groups, in other words, your frontline phone call handlers and your back-end bug fixers, things like that, that's moved out into the community. And that's part of the trade, is that for the in exchange for it being open source, everybody can just take it and do what they want to with it generally, you also get people fixing bugs and providing support outside the original company as well. So this is really where how open source makes it work for everybody.
Well, I think that, I'm really looking forward to talking to Jono, and we're going to get to him as he's going to call in. Where is he? He's at an event, of course.
He's at a conference in L.A. somewhere, I think it is.
Yeah.
West Coast somewhere.
Naturally. So he's going to talk to us about Ubuntu, about the community, what the role of a community is in terms of whether is it kind of engineering or marketing or both. You know?
Yes, and also about his upcoming book, which he's got a O'Reilly book deal with, and he's writing this book using Creative Commons. So we're actually getting to see chapters of the book show up online. He's been very visible about it in the Art of Community, I think it's called. So that's been very visible, and he's really doesn't just talk the talk; he walks the walk, because the music you just heard, some would call it music anyway. You just heard.
Hey, say that before he comes on here.
Hope he's not listening yet. Yeah. That's Creative Commons, and the book he's doing with O'Reilly is Creative Commons, and so he's walking the walk. This is the important thing, and he's also, from what I understand, one of the most successful community developers in a long time. So I'm really glad that he's getting that written down so that other groups can duplicate his successful work. So this will be really, really cool.
Hold on. Before we talk to you, Jono. One last chance to mention the Google Summer of Code. Don't let me forget to do that. The Summer of Code is coming. Now, it's too late if you haven't already applied for the Summer of Code project. Google does this every year for the last 5 years. It is incredible. It starts with the mentor organizations, people who are running open source projects. First of all, submitting proposals to Google. Google then selects 150 mentor organizations to participate in the Summer of Code, post their requests on the website. Students go to the website, review the lists, email the mentor organizations, you know, kind of talk to them, and then apply for the Summer of Code. This is an amazing thing. Now, the students have already applied for the program. They're waiting right now to see if they've been selected. If you're one of the people who applied, I wish you all the best. About 1,000 students get selected. Here is an amazing opportunity to get paid to code, to get that line on your resume that says Google Summer of Code. So many Summer of Code participants have gone on to big things in open source. It is such an important project, and we are so glad we could support Google in the Summer of Code project. We'll, I'm sure, this summer be talking about some of the interesting work that's being done. A global program offering student developers the opportunity to get paid to write code for open source projects. What's not to love about that? Thank you, Google, for doing it. Thank you for supporting Floss Weekly as well. And the best of luck to all the young developers who have applied this year. The mentor projects, thank you for participating. It's going to be a great Summer of Code. We'll talk a lot more about it. And you can read more about it if you want to. code.google.com/SOC, Summer of Code. code.google.com/SOC. If you get involved, make sure you say, hey, I heard it on Floss Weekly, because we'd like to come back and do this again next summer. It's really been a wonderful thing for Google to support us and for us to be able to support such a great program. Now, sorry, Jono, now it's Jono Bacon's turn.
Hey, guys.
And there he is, Mr. Bacon. Hello, Jono.
Hey, how you doing?
So glad you could join us.
Yeah, great to be here.
And almost as if on cue. That's really good.
It looks like my cameras are working properly then.
Very good. Oh, good. Now, what is the event you're at, the conference you're at right now?
Right now at the Linux Collaboration Summit, just literally got off a panel about measuring community. So, it was a lot of fun. It's a good event. It's my first time. So,
how do you measure them? With like a ruler? Or
please.
A very, very long ruler and a lot of peanuts.
I think you're in a really interesting position to kind of learn about community and how a community can impact a project like Ubuntu, but also how to manage it and how to cultivate it. I mean, all of these things are new, really. I mean, this isn't something that people have had to do. Nabisco didn't really have to worry about its community until recently, right?
It's interesting. I mean, one thing that we were talking about in the panel is the fact that community is still very much an inexact science. In the last 10 years or so of particularly the open source community really beginning to find its feet, you know, we're always learning about how contributors can get involved. So as an example, 10 years ago, to get involved in Linux, you basically had to be able to program in C, and you pretty much required a very, very long beard as well. And
a Richard Stallman length beard, huh?
Exactly. And nowadays, you know, people without beards can get involved, and you know, people are getting involved in translations and documentation and all manner of different things. And I think there's been an evolution as we've understood what the barriers to entry are and how we can enable those kinds of diversity. So I think we've made some really interesting progress, but it's still very much, you know, we're still learning and a lot of learning to do.
Do you find this always a positive, or can community kind of be a pain in the keister sometimes?
Oh, it can be a pain at times.
let's be honest. I mean, normally you kind of don't want to say that because you don't want to irritate the community. But I think on balance, it's very, very cool and valuable.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing is, I mean, it's like if you go out into the street and you randomly pick 100 people, you can have some people in there who are really great, and you can have some people in there who are really not great. and then you're going to have some people in there who are complete and it's community's no different. You know, there's people who, you know, I get up every morning when I get involved with the communities that I'm involved in. You know, I get up, I meet some of these people and they inspire me in many
yes,
ways.
Yeah.
And then there's some people, unfortunately, frustrate, and you know, it's never going to be 100% perfect any of the time. Like you said, you know, I think the proportion is massively in favor of people who are doing good work and who have got a good attitude and outlook towards what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Do you think that's particularly because it's open source? It would have to attract people that were more cooperative to begin with?
Oh, I bet not. Oh, I'm willing to bet not, but go ahead. Let's hear.
I think what open source has given a lot of people is the ability, it sounds tacky, but the ability to dream about how they can be involved in making a difference. And some people get involved and they feel this unbridled sense of opportunity. And that really, that brings out amazing things in people. It makes people take control of their own destiny and how they can contribute towards those projects. But on the other side of things, you know, look at these kind of pretentious rock stars who make a lot of money very quickly and get a lot of fame very quickly. It goes to their head, and then it's a lifestyle of hookers and drugs and throwing televisions out of windows.
And if you're Prince, suing your listeners, suing your audience.
Exactly. That's never a good thing.
So not a good idea. No.
I think that it definitely spins. It spins both ways. The biggest risk in my mind, something that I've talked about in the book is the enemy to community is when people feel a sense of entitlement. When people start thinking, you know what, I should be treated this way because of who I am and because I've done this. And that is, you know, that is the enemy. People should rightly feel a sense of respect for their contributions. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they should feel a sense of entitlement. And
it's a natural human thing, though. How do you deal with it? How do you kind of create the expectation that we're not going to do that?
Well, I think a lot of it is, I think a lot of it is about balancing people regularly. I think it's like any human behavior. You know, like the analogy here is, you know, we all probably know someone like this. Somebody starts out, they probably go to university and they study, and then they get into a job and they do well in that particular company, and then they get into a bigger job and then they do well in that company, and they start buying fast cars and big apartments, and then they get another job and they do even better in that company. But while their success has grown, the sense of ego has grown as well.
Yeah.
And then every so often something will happen that brings them crashing down to earth to make them realize that, you know what, you're just another human being. Your achievements are not necessarily any better than, you know, than a guy in a developing country who has managed to bring some food to his family after walking 6 or 7 miles that day. You know, it's a different style of achievement, a different sense of achievement, but both are achievements nonetheless. And I think that it's important to ground people, you know, and every so often it requires tough conversations, you know, in every community. Sometimes you've got to, when we start seeing this sense of entitlement, somebody has got to sit down with them. And this is something I've had to do in the past, is to sit down and say, look, you know, we need to have a conversation and lay things on the line a little bit. But it's never an easy situation to deal with. Yeah. Conflict is never fun.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because that would be sort of your particular job, perhaps. And if somebody doesn't have, if a community doesn't have like a community manager, at least somebody who sort of is an ad hoc community manager, that role often doesn't get done and you end up with spiraling egos.
I think so. I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, every community's got things they don't really want to do. Like, everybody wants to do fun things. Everybody wants to work on the fun projects and to do the fun work in the projects. But there's some of the things that most people don't like doing. I mean, you know, fun is individual. Some people find writing insane GUI applications a lot of fun. Some people find maintaining kernel modules fun. But nobody really finds conflicts fun. Nobody really finds having to sit down and have that conversation fun with anybody. So I think having a formalized community manager means that you've actually got someone who can deal with that kind of stuff. So long as it's dealt with effectively, obviously.
Well, you must find it a little fun or you wouldn't be doing the job.
I think it is. I mean...
Oh, wow. I'm surprised to hear you say it's not great. It's great fun. I mean, on the balance, it must be gratifying anyway. Do you feel like you have to act like a cop?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, so one thing that is definitely satisfying is, like, every so often you'll find a community member who is absolutely seething about something.
Right.
And there's a sense of satisfaction in translating that crazy, unstructured frustration into a structured way forward. So, you know, what we want to do is, you know, if you've got someone who's frustrated or annoyed or about something in particular, what we want to do is we want to fix the problem. And to do that, we need to convert that sense of frustration into a plan. And, you know, that plan could be, you know, give me some evidence, give me something I can work with, and then we can start having conversations and we can start figuring out a solution to the problem. And, you know, when we start feeling that sense of plan, that is a satisfying feeling. And it's a satisfying feeling, you know, getting to unblock problems. One of the first things I dealt with when I started working on Ubuntu was there was one particular loco team, one of our local user groups, and there was a bit of a war in this team. You know, there was dissent. There was two people who thought they were leaders, and they were arguing, and it was ripping the team apart. And So I went in there and organized some meetings and said, look, the only thing I can work on is evidence. I can't work with emotional vitriol. So I said, you know, send me some evidence. And I got like 66 emails.
I have
night.
A transcript here of a chat room conversation in which... I get that one a lot, by the way.
Yeah, and it was like this outburst of evidence, yeah. and it was detailed. But with that, I could actually move forward, and right. It only required one more meeting to unblock those problems. You know, to identify what brings the team together as opposed to what separates it. And
it's been my experience, and I'm curious if it's yours, that oftentimes these people who are the most vocal end up being the most ardent contributors. And they care. So if you can work with them, they often are well worth the effort that it takes.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And the thing is, as well, I think it's, you know, I've learned as well is that, you know, particularly in an open community, people really, really put, you know, they wear their hearts on their sleeves, and they. You know, they're so familiar. We're all so familiar with a very open culture in which, we blog about what we're doing. We micro-blog about the uninteresting stuff that we're doing. And
really, every detail is completely available at any time.
Exactly. It's like, I got up today, I scratched my left leg. That requires a Twitter message, you know. And so I think we used to living out in the open, wearing our hearts on a string. And consequently, we see people change and develop out in the open as well. And we see people mature. You know, there's many examples where people have joined a community and they make many of the same missteps. And it's purely because they're new and they haven't got used to the culture. And also, a lot of these people are very young. And while I never ever want to be ageist and say, you know, only older people can join the project, some people mature in life, and you know, as you get older, generally people get wiser, and you know, that affects all of us. So, you know, I think we see these changes happening, and it is very satisfying when we can take passionate people and have them channel their passion in a way that is not spreading frustration and irritation. So
We should probably back up a step and kind of ask what your general responsibilities are as a community manager, just so everybody's on the same page here.
And how you got, I want to find out how you got involved too.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll start with how I got involved. I mean, so my background is I started in Linux sort of 10, 11, 12 years ago, something like that, 1998. So 10 years, I guess. 11 years. What am I talking about? 11 years ago, got involved in Linux. My brother installed it on my PC. It took 2 weeks to install and a soldering iron. It was so complicated.
Software shouldn't require any soldering, generally speaking.
It literally involved a soldering iron.
That's amazing.
I remember getting this book, this Slackware Unleashed, and this book was, 600 pages.
I read that book. I tried to install it. Never did get Slackware running. Maybe I needed a soldering iron.
I certainly never saw it unleashed in any way.
Yeah.
But I never read that book. The only thing I read was the first 5 or 6 pages where it talked about, this group of people from all around the world come together to make something. And I thought that was a fascinating concept and sort of stuck with it. And I wasn't a particularly technical person at the time, so I was really struggling. But anyway, got involved. And then basically became more and more involved in open source. I set up a website called Linux UK, which was like the first UK-based community website. It was made in Microsoft Front Page, actually, at the time. So I created this website, went on to contribute to KDE, and then I went to university and became a journalist. Wrote for a bunch of magazines, wrote a couple of books, and then I went to work at a consultancy, like a UK government funded consultancy that basically helped spread open source in the West Midlands part of the UK. And that was where I really got an opportunity to cut my teeth with the community. I got to meet different styles of community and was there for a couple of years, and then the opportunity to go and work at Canonical came up, and went and interviewed a few times and got the job. And I started there tail end of 2006, and it's been a fun ride so far. And it's basically my responsibility is to try and it's fundamentally to enable the Ubuntu community to do good work. And so that comes in at different levels. One aspect is strategic level, to try and identify areas in which we can improve how we work in a collaborative community, and to also to help push those initiatives forward, growing the number of local user groups that we've got, improving how technical collaboration works, such as bug workflow and patch management and review and things like that, and how all of these technical processes fit together.
Who was it that saw that this was something Ubuntu needed? Was it Mark, or was who said we need a community manager?
I think it was probably Mark. I mean, one thing that's been really helpful has been the fact that the company, this sounds like I'm spinning you a line, but I really genuinely mean this, that the company really has a solid understanding and respect for community. It happens at every level. I mean, the company's grown pretty big now. We've got, we're 200 and odd people, and I mean, I've got a team of three people working for me, so like every aspect of the company's grown out. And But throughout that, the company's always retained an importance in respect towards community. And, every week I get emails from the marketing department and the business development team and the OEM team and the Launchpad team and the Bazaar team and the rest of the Ubuntu team about how we can engage and work with the community. So there's a culture there of community. And I think Mark is the person who really pushed that forward because, he's at his heart. I mean, he's a tremendous businessman. He's a really great thinker, but he's at his heart, he's just a free software, open source nerd.
And, that's great.
So that's why they hired you, because before that, all those mails went to nobody.
Well, was there somebody before you did this? Were you the first community manager?
Well, the person I was the first formalized community manager, but the person who really preceded me was a guy called Benjamin Mako Hill. And Mako is someone who I have unbridled respect for. He put in place a lot of the community, like the community council and the code of conduct, and a lot of the stuff that we lean on today in the Ubuntu community, Mako deserves the credit for. And he's one of those people that, like, you never quite know what he's going to be doing next. Like, I saw him in Boston a few weeks back, and he's you know, he's studying business now, and he was working in some art department at MIT the last time I saw him. He's a really fun and slightly crazy guy. So mm-hmm. yeah, he was doing that kind of stuff beforehand, and then he moved on, and I think that the company at the time really realized that there was a need for this kind of role to be filled out. So, but I think it was the first formal. I think it's the first distribution to formalize a community management role. At the time, I wasn't aware of any other community manager for any of the other distros.
And how's it changed now?
Well, since now, I mean, it's changed. We, you know, many of the distributions have got community managers. So the panel I was just on, actually, one of the guys from Red Hat, who used to work on Fedora, he works a bit less on Fedora now, was there, Carsten. And then there's Joe from OpenSUSE. He's there. And then there was a guy at Mandriva, but he's moved on now. I think he's at Red Hat. So there's definitely been some growth in the area. So.
And so what do you spend most of your day doing? I mean, I know you go to conferences and make presentations. You work with local user groups. You work within the company to coordinate community things. How many other things do you do?
It's the one thing I love about the work is that it's a really diverse week. Loads of different areas. So like, you know, one aspect is managing the team, you know, helping the team to do their work and checking in with them, weekly calls and building strategy and objectives and all that kind of stuff. The other thing is working with the loco teams, helping to unblock things, conflict resolution, working with the other members of the other teams in the company. Some of the stuff that I used to do when it was just me, I've moved towards, you know, some of the guys in the team. So for example, you know, things like approving mailing lists and, you know, kind of resource level stuff, you know, George looks after, and some of the work with the developer community, Daniel's in charge of. So a lot of the stuff that I was kind of focusing on at first has now been handled by the rest of the team. But it's all manner of different things, you know. But most of it is replying to email, making wiki pages, and talking on IRC. I'm being on the phone as well. I mean, I'm in California, so like I used to live in England, and so my mornings are just I'm on the phone constantly. Where the crossover with England is. So every morning from 7 a.m. until midday is pretty much solid phone calls. And then the rest of the day I can actually start replying to email and work on other stuff.
Now, do you find community to be the entire, everybody that would be running or has Ubuntu around? Or are you looking more at the developer end of that? Or is it just, I mean, how do you define community?
That's a really interesting question, because I think that traditionally, we've considered community within the team as contributors, people who are doing something with Ubuntu, and it's never specifically focused on any particular type of contribution. I mean, we have a natural gravitation more towards developers, and you know, Daniel Holbach is he leads that part of the team. But the community side of things as well, we're really keen to focus on other aspects. So, for example, documentation and translation. So a new guy just joined on Monday, David Planella. He's focused on the translations community and helping for us to build that out and build a really thriving environment for translations. But it's all manner of different things. It's tempting to kind of focus on specific communities because there's the most kind of worth and satisfaction in that area. You know, I mean, if you have somebody who's doing packaging and development, it has a very real and visual feel on the distribution. You know, bugs get fixed. People don't face problems that they did have. Whereas some of the contributions that people make to Ubuntu are more subtle. So people who are involved in loco teams are going out to conferences and, you know, doing talks and having booths and printing out flyers and giving them out to people. Whereas, you know, if somebody's in Guatemala and they're doing a conference over there, we're not going to feel the change over here in California or other parts of the world. So I think it's important to remember that great community is happening all over the world, but to always remember that everybody needs support instead of just focusing on the areas where you feel the most immediate kind of reward. But the other thing, which we've been thinking about recently, is of course the user community. Like the Ubuntu forums are huge. I mean, there's millions of posts on the Ubuntu forums. And they had like a one, I haven't got the stats in front of me, but at one point, I think it was around the last release, they had something like 45,000 users online at the same time.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, they're a huge forum, and that's predominantly full of users, you know.
Because one of the things I understand about Ubuntu that sort of, at least initially, distinguished itself from all the other Linux distributions is was the sort of user friendliness that was being added to it. So it really was more for maybe a guy who would never write necessarily a shell script or a piece of C code, but really is sort of their end user desktop. And I so, think so yeah. Having to include that as part of your community sounds like a natural thing for you to take on.
Yeah, and it's something that I'm really keen for us to focus on in the future is we still, to be frank, the team is still very contributor-focused. I mean, we very much, the predominance of what we do is helping people be a participant in Ubuntu in different ways. Mm-hmm. But I'd like us to start focusing more on the user community at some point in the future, because I think, you know, we're seeing more and more netbooks running Ubuntu, and we're seeing, you know, more and more laptops running Ubuntu, and people are using it in different ways, and I think we need to be able to support that demographic of people well. But you know, when you know what it's like, you know, when you've got 1,001 things to do in a day, and you can only do 1,000 of them, you know, you've got to bump something. And I think that our predominance is to just focus on the participatory stuff. So.
Right, exactly. I mean, like we had Agostino Russo on a few weeks ago, and he was talking about Wubi, and then there was something like millions of downloads, literally millions of downloads of people converting from Windows then to running Ubuntu that are probably just going to be end users.
Yeah, I mean, but there's a guy you love. I mean, that's exactly the kind of participation you
want. He's fantastic. I mean, he's not only made a really great contribution, but he's just an endemically cool guy.
Yeah.
It's like... You know, that's the one thing I really love about communities, like, is that community is not just about what you do, but it's about the people who bring it. And, you know, it's very tempting, particularly with IT, because we're so used to putting things in boxes and rearranging the boxes. And we're so used to, you know, managerializing everything, you know, trying to split everything into success criteria and deliverables and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we forget the real social opportunity of community is the fact that you just get to meet cool people who are doing great things. And Agostino is a great example of that. Like when I first met him, I was like, I just like this guy, you know, he's done some good work, and he just is someone I enjoy seeing, you know.
Now, how is this all going to get translated into this wonderful book you have coming up?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the website. I can't wait to read this book. By the way, Colleen just handed me an Ubuntu soldering iron. So I guess it's not it's not just Slackware. I don't know why she has Ubuntu sticker on her soldering iron. Maybe it's just true love is what it is.
We're trying to expand, you know.
It's called The Art of Community, and you can actually participate online at artofcommunityonline.org, which I think is just, I love it when people do this. And
it's been fun. I mean, the way this happened was there's a guy at O'Reilly called Andy Oram, and he was someone who I was kind of familiar with, but I'd never really spoken to him before. He's like part of the old guard of O'Reilly. He's been there for years. And I think he was actually responsible for behind editing some of the very first Linux books that came out at O'Reilly. So, and he emailed me one time to just have a chat about something unrelated to do with the community, which was, you know, community and some educational project. And we got chatting, and he said, you know, I'd be really interested in talking about you writing a community book. And it's something that I've been wanting to do, but I was always planning on doing it later on, you know, to make sure that I've got 3 or 4 years of community organizational stuff under my belt, but I was wanting to really kind of wait until sort of 5 years to really start thinking about doing something. But, you know, Andy was interested in doing it. There was the opportunity for it to be published by O'Reilly, which is a company I've got huge respect for.
Oh, yeah.
I used to be a bit of an O'Reilly nerd when I was younger, because I used to work in a bookshop, and my manager let me take any of the O'Reilly books home with me.
Oh, wow.
So I like developed this library of
a little menagerie of animals is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. These were really old O'Reilly books. I mean, these were, you know, UUCP books and stuff like that. So anyway, the Pearl Book is legendary.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Camel. And I've got somewhere, Camel book. Somewhere I've got the Send Mail book, which is about 8 inches thick. That's another.
Yeah.
That's another fun read for late at night. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my idea of fun, is reading a book of Send Mail.
Oh yeah.
That's a fate worse than death, you know.
Pair that up with Slackware Unleashed, and you got it. You've got bedside. You got a bedside table, actually.
Exactly. Exactly. So. So anyway, there was O'Reilly, working with Andy Orr on the opportunity to write the book, and also, Andy was keen for it to be licensed under the Creative Commons as well.
That's awesome.
And, and I just thought this is too good of an opportunity to pass. So we started working out. I sent him an outline, and the idea of this is that I've been doing a talk for a while called Building Belonging, which is basically talking about how belonging is the end game for community. We want people to feel a sense of belonging, because when they feel belonging, they want to stick around, because they feel like they feel like they're useful and valued.
Right.
And the way in which we typically share best practice in community is through stories. I've been at the Linux Collab Summit since this morning, and I've already heard 4 or 5 really interesting stories of what's going on with people's lives, and you kind of take something away from those stories that helps you change your own outlook on the world a little bit. So my idea was I wanted to write a book about community that is full of stories, that's full of little examples and anecdotes and experiences from myself and other people about how community can work in different ways. And that's basically where the idea came from. And started working on it, and I finished the first draft of it about a week ago, and so we're just onto the edits now. So it should be hopefully ready over the next month or so.
Talk about what it means to put that under Creative Commons, because I know you're really strong about that. Tell me what that means to you as an author.
I think that where I was excited about it is that, I think that it's important that this book is my take on things, and it's important to remember that it's just one person's perspective. It's not the be all end all of how to do things. But I was really keen for people to have access to that information, and the Creative Commons means that people can take that information, like somebody who hasn't got any money, who wants to build a community around, if they want to build a small knitting group in their area and they've got no money to their name. Someone can give them a copy of the book, or they can go online and they can get a copy of the book, and they can start building a community right there and then. But other people who have got money can go out and buy a copy of the book, and they can contribute to the project. And I like the fact that it puts the information up. It makes the information accessible to everybody. And that in itself is the essence of community. If the whole point of community is to remove barriers for participation, and I was very keen to remove the barrier behind the book as well. And I was actually planning on asking Andy for it to be available under the Creative Commons, because I know O'Reilly had done some other books, but he beat me to it, and he was like, "I think we should do this." So I was like, "I'm all for that, Andy." So I think it's exciting that people will be able to access it, but I'd like to also think that people will go out and buy the book and show O'Reilly that it's first of all, it's a valuable book, and B, these kinds of Creative Commons efforts by O'Reilly are valued, and people will go out and support them. So.
Well, people like Cory Doctorow, Paul Coelho, a lot of people have experience of putting stuff online, and it only helps sales. It doesn't hurt sales at all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I can think of a lot of examples of books. Joachim Benkler's The Wealth of Networks, which Yale University Press put online.
Yeah.
I read about 3 chapters and I said, I've got to buy this. And I think that's really, and I'll certainly buy the paper version, the dead tree version of your book.
The dead tree version, yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, Lessig has talked a lot about this as well. Yeah. And I think that it's, I think that it's, I'm pretty excited. I mean, the thing is, as you guys probably know, none of us are going to be rich from writing books. Not these kinds of books.
I know it better than anyone.
Yeah.
Actually, Randall and I know it pretty well together, actually. Kind of
exactly.
Thing. Yeah.
And it's like, we're not Stephen King, you're never going to make money, that much money from writing a book like this. The most important thing to me is I just wanted to write a book that I'd be proud of, that will help people build communities. And I don't care what those communities are. And so I've tried to produce a book which is relatively generic, and I've also, so it can be applied to any community, but I've also tried to make sure that the book is a really loose and easy read, because the problem with communities is it can descend into social science nonsense very quickly. Right. And people talking about very ethereal concepts. And you know, I want people to be able to read this and have a bit of a giggle when they're reading it as well. So there's lots of stupid British humor in there.
I like that.
is this
the Monty Python of community books. I like that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. It's about time. Not much spam in it either, I understand. No, I think you're the right guy to write this, though. And the reason I'm most interested in it is I want to, you know, yeah, you could write about sociology, but I want to hear from somebody who's doing it on the practical, real world, anecdotal stuff that happens and how you handle it and what worked. I think that's really important.
Well, I think that's, you know, it's kind of like the father-in-law syndrome, you know? It's like every time I meet with my father-in-law, he teaches me a new thing about the world. He has no idea he's doing it, you know, but he's just someone who likes to tell tales and tell stories. And I'm not necessarily saying I can teach anybody anything new about the world, but I like to tell stories and tales as well. And you know, I'm hoping it's a bit nerve-wracking because, you know, there's not many books on this subject, and I'm hoping that it's going to be a good first shot. And I'd like to think that we'll see future editions where I continue to refine it and building it and make it into something that people find useful.
I was just going to ask that. Do you see this as a living book? I mean, right after you publish it, are you just going to continue, like, maybe to wikify it or something, or make a way for people to contribute new sections? And sort of in retrospect, how much of the current writing was contributed during the writing process by other people?
So the plan is that this is absolutely going to be something which I want to maintain and work on continually. The website is going to be a center point for that. So, you know, I'd like it to, the plan here is, you know, I absolutely would like there to be future editions of the book. You know, the science of how you build community is still changing and refining, and people are still learning so much all the time. So I think there will be a lot of value in each new edition. Mm-hmm. I'm not planning on kind of like refining it in terms of a wiki. I think we talked about this for a while about how we could have people kind of work on the book together. And that's originally the Art of Community was actually Andy's dream at first, was to have a bunch of people come together to work on a book as like a combined effort, like a number of authors essentially building a book using open source methodologies, but it didn't really work out.
That's like herding cats. No.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So it's kind of, I think it's helpful to have somebody to kind of editorialize the content and to put it in there. What I think is really important is to have a place where people can submit content for the book, to submit interesting ideas and concepts. And so you asked about how, you know, what submitted content has gone into the book. I've written all of the content myself, but what I've done is I've gathered tons of interview content. So, for example, I interviewed Chris Messina, who was behind Spread Firefox, and Leslie Hawthorne from Google. And there's loads of these little interviews and references and stories that have been submitted from people that add value to illustrate different parts of the book. And it's still ongoing as well. There's still sections in the book where I read it now, and I think that needs a story to help paint a picture. So I'd like to think that will continue more and more and more. And then once the first edition's out, I'd like to think that we can continue to add new content. I mean, there's tons of stuff which is not in, which I would like to have written and put in there that I just didn't have time to write because the schedule was so tight. So,
yeah, I sort of feel the same way about Floss Weekly, that what we're getting to are people's stories. It's not just the technology, but the story behind the technology that really makes this show really something that our audience is listening to. So, yeah. So I think we got 64 stories if you want 64 more.
Exactly. Well, I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, people who are, I think stories make it fun and interesting. I mean, technology in itself is good fun, but I think the way people use it and the way people build opportunities out of it is the really fun aspect of it. You know, if we were just excited about how people can use technology in very specific ways, then we'd be bureaucrats. And you know, but we're enthusiasts who enjoy what opportunities this offers for us. So hopefully you guys will like it.
what's the production schedule? Going to be out by the end of the year?
Yeah, we're shooting for August. We always very generically said summer, but
we didn't say which summer, did you?
exactly. Summer 2012. But no, the we're shooting for August.
Okay.
I'm trying to get the absolute final, all the edits in, draft done by May the 15th. Yes. And then that will give us some time. So that's the plan, is to have it out in August.
You do know that August can be renumbered to have 75 days if you need to.
Old author's trick.
You have the power.
Yeah, old author's trick.
August 62nd.
Yeah, I thought it was the 65th. I'm so sorry.
Exactly. So, yeah, no, everything's broadly on track. So, but, you know, it's a pretty busy time right now with the Ubuntu release coming out and everything else. So,
yeah.
I'm looking forward to having my evenings and weekends back when this is done.
So speaking of Creative Commons, is a nice segue. We played a little snippet of your music from severedfifth.com in the opening. And
okay.
I just wanted to speak a little bit about that aspect of your existence, because that also reflects Creative Commons and your stand on that.
So it's good to know that after you played that there's no listeners left anymore.
So. No, that's good. Are you on the? Let's play a little bit more. Here we go. Ah, so are you on the guitar or the drums? What is?
Well, basically everything.
The whole thing.
So yeah, what I did was I wanted to write. I've always been really into music, and I wanted to write an entirely solo album.
That's so cool.
Basically, played all the drums, the guitars, the bass, the vocals, and then recorded in my home studio in England.
And using Ubuntu, of course.
Yeah.
So he says.
Not quite. I used Cubase and a Mac. So pretty much about as unfree as you can get. So it was like a whole new level. But
don't worry, we won't tell anybody.
But no, it'll be our little secret, you know. So I wanted to put something together. I was like, one thing I was thinking a lot about at the time was the fact that, you know, we hear about people like Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails coming out and saying that they were releasing content under a Creative Commons license. But, you know, those people have got their reputations already established in the wider music industry. So it's you know, they've done the hardest job, which is building a fan base. You know, me? No fan base. So I was like, well, you know, what can I do to put together an album, put it out there, and then see what we can do with it, and see if we can build some awareness around an artist who's got no fan base.
But that's really part of a larger question about community in general, which is, and a lot of people ask me this, because I am in the same situation where I had a community that I brought to the table. Mm. What do you do if you are a creator, an artist, a writer, a musician, a movie maker, and you don't have a community? You're just starting out. How do you build community?
Yeah. I think that's one of the hardest things that is to get started. I think the thing is that, you know, community is very self-referential. So, you know, so for example, when I was doing the Severed Fifth, when I released the album, I was blogging about it, but my blog is already on Planet Ubuntu. It's already on Planet GNOME. It's read by people who are watching my work from the Linux side of things. So, some of those people are going to like the music, and some of those people are going to stick to the project. So it's very self-referential. If you've got no blog on no planet, and you haven't got that kind of reputation first, it's obviously going to be more of an uphill struggle. I think the key thing is to just be ballsy. Just go out there and just give it your best shot.
Sure.
I mean, and, you know, crazy ideas. You know, I mean, I emailed. So I'm really into metal. And I've got, in my Banshee music player, I've got 365 artists. And I emailed every one of them to tell them about the album.
Great.
It took me ages. Mm. And some of them got back to me and were like, hey, that's pretty cool. And some of them, some were like, don't bother me.
Hey, at least it's a response.
But you know what? It's like, if you don't send, you know, there's no harm in
it. Put yourself out there.
You just go, you know, give it a go. I mean, I wasn't promising them that it was going to be the best thing they're ever going to hear, because it's not. But, you know, it's like, just give it a go, you know, no harm. And then that builds other little things, like other little opportunities and little things. So, you know, the manager of the Gypsy Kings, got chatting to him, met him in Macy's.
Well, there you go.
And we went to, you know, went to the Gypsy Kings and got to meet them. And we're talking about that music, and he was really interested and all the rest of it. So it's like just little things, you know, putting it out there. And I think it's about being ballsy and then just building on that and building some steam.
You know, it's interesting because it sounds like what you have to do with that is the same thing that I would have to do with a piece of software that I had just written that I was really excited about, because I wrote it for me and it helps me, but I want to also have other people find out about it. So you're just doing the same analogy with music. And so is some of this going into the community book?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a chapter in the community book about all about building buzz and trying to excite people about different things. And it's very difficult because it's so, one of the hardest things about writing the book was the fact that community is so, it's so dependent on the project. So like, you know, it's impossible to write effectively how to generically build excitement around a community without knowing what the community is in the first place.
Right.
So the way you build excitement around an open source project is very different to how you build excitement around a, you know, if you were setting up a convention or a band or a movie or something.
And if you do it wrong, you end up sounding like Herb Tarlick. So you have to be really careful.
Yeah. I think, you know, so for example, it's, you know, for example, with the software projects, you know, there's, I think a lot of it is about really exercising the, particularly in open source projects, is about exercising the participatory nature of the project, like going out there and saying, hey, check it out. We've got this, you know, we've got this, this source code repository. There's a wiki here, which you can contribute to. Here's a mailing list. There's some discussion going on. We're building up some specifications, you know, and blogging about progress and what's happening and targeting very specific groups. You know, like if you're writing a GNOME application, you're going to target the GNOME groups. Mm-hmm. But with a movie, it's kind of like, I don't know. I mean, you're going to want to target some related groups on the internet, but you're probably going to be wanting more to get out there and have it shown in small local theaters and stuff like that. So it's very dependent. And that's one of the hardest things around that chapter is the fact that it was, you know, it's very difficult to write in a generic sense about this kind of stuff. So
have you considered taking just specifically about your music? Have you considered publishing the individual tracks, the individual cuts, so people could remix it by taking their own drum track and applying it to your guitar playing?
Yeah. It's something I'm definitely planning on doing. Part of the problem is the fact that so I moved to California recently, and my stuff from England hasn't arrived yet.
Okay.
So my, you know, when I packed up all my stuff, it's like it's 14 boxes of stuff, and 13 boxes are all musical instruments and stuff. Wow. You know, there's like 13 boxes of musical related nonsense and one box of clothes. And everything else went into the bin or to friends. And I'd like to release some of the individual tracks so people can start playing with this. One of the problem with the Severed Fifth is that as soon as the project came out, and you know, shortly into the project coming out, and I was building up the steam there, that's when the opportunity for the Art of Community came up. And it would have been nice for the Art of Community to have kind of waited a year or 6 months so I could have spent my spare time focusing on that. So Severed Fifth has taken a bit of a back burner while I've done the book, but I want to get back to it once I finish the book. So, but yeah, I really want to kind of get the original tracks out there. I like the idea of people coming up with crazy drum and bass and trance and rap and whatever else they can with the guttural growling nonsense that I put out. So,
I'm sure some of our audience will love to do this as soon as you get it. So just let us know and we'll start announcing where to go and when. So
that'd be
perfect for that stuff. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That'd be really fun to see what madness ensues from that.
Now, is this what is in reference to when somebody said, like, the moment I announced that you were going to be on the show, I got an email the next day that said, be sure to ask Jono, when is he putting the band back together? Is that what they were
talking about? It's a one-man band. That's an interestingly loaded question, actually.
Are they talking about Lug Radio?
I think that's probably Lug Radio. Yeah,
so we miss Lug Radio.
Let's talk about Lug Radio. What's that about? What was that about, I should say?
So Lug Radio was basically the idea of... when I first went to university, when I was 18 and 19, I set up a Linux user group in the town that I was in. Now, the town I used to live in England is a place called Wolverhampton. And Wolverhampton is the only fair and balanced way of describing it is as a complete and total dump.
It's not as bad as Slough.
Slough.
Slough? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, Slough.
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 Slough, Slough, Slough.
In crazy English.
In America, you could pronounce it all three ways.
That's right.
I can't believe it. You're taking out language and butchering it.
Slough is where The Office took place, and I am told is one of the worst places in Britain.
Oh, it's
worse than Wolverhampton, even.
Yes. Well, Wolverhampton's. It's a bit of it's just a very, very industrial part of England.
Right.
It strikes me as a bit like Detroit, you know, that kind of like very industrial, kind of cold, kind of feeling area. Don't want to offend anyone in Detroit right now.
You know, the good news is there's no one left, so it's okay.
So, exactly. So anyway, set up this group in Wolverhampton and people started coming along. And I went to a couple of Linux user groups beforehand, and they were really boring, you know? I mean, they were like, you know, a bunch of people stood around talking about Emacs switches. And, that was not my idea of fun. I really like people who are really passionate about something, but are a lot of fun as well. People who, you can have a good time with. And that good time might be talking about something ridiculous, but something to do with technology, but you have a good time nonetheless. So I really wanted the group to be just very, very social. So we held this group in a pub, and then we started holding it in a curry house. And we used to have curry every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And anyway, this kind of core group of people in the Wolverhampton Linux user group became very, very loud and often dominated the conversation. And we basically took the four people from that group and formed Lug Radio. And Lug Radio was, the idea was that the Lug meetings, I mean, they were so funny. I remember going home and waking up the following day, and my stomach would be aching from laughing so much the night before. They were so funny.
That's a user group.
And it was so much fun, so much fun. But we really liked the idea of taking that and putting it on the internet. And the idea was to do Lug Radio. So we did that, and it was to basically produce a show that's about open source that's completely irreverent and some of the stuff we did in the show was pretty ridiculous in retrospect. And
Randall, this is a good idea. I think sometimes we're all together too reverent.
we can be a little less reverent if you want.
I don't know about that.
Be a little less reverent.
Yeah. But it was like, we liked the idea of like, when we started doing the show, it was really anarchic in many ways, because we didn't want to become a very traditional podcast.
Yeah,
we wanted
great.
To be
yeah.
really pushed. So I'll give you an example. We had Ian Murdoch, right? You know, one guy behind Debian. Ian Murdoch came on, was going to be doing the interview in the show. And Ian Murdoch, you know, we're all big A-Team fans, so we called him Howlin' Mad throughout the entire interview. And what we normally do is, you know, we dial people up on the phone. And what we did is I figured out how to play, using the touch tones on the phone, how to play the intro music from the A-Team. So we said, you know, it was like, so, okay, now on the show we're gonna interview Howlin' Mad Ian Murdoch from Sun. Like, and then you hear like the and you hear like
as long as somebody doesn't go, hello. Hello? Why do you keep calling me every week?
It was one ridiculous thing after another, and the show became pretty popular, and people seemed to enjoy it, even though it was ridiculous at times, and the community developed around it. And then we started doing these live shows called Lug Radio Live, which we did every year. And we're actually doing it later this year in England again, even though we stopped doing the podcast now, but we're still doing the live shows in England once a year. So.
What was it like meeting your fans for the first time from that show?
Sorry?
What was it like meeting your fans for the first time from that show?
Really, really scary. The first time we did a Lug Radio Live, we did it in this tiny little backroom pub in Wolverhampton on the edge of the football stadium, right? So, you know, we organized this one-day event. We weren't sure how it was going to work. We expected we would be happy if 60 people showed up, and we were terrified no one was going to show up. And we had Mark Shuttleworth. This is before I was at Canonical. Mark Shuttleworth was going to be keynoting. Mm. You know, keynoting in this event was basically talking louder than anybody else. So that's the kind of event that it was.
The guy with the mic.
And, you know, we were really trying to push out this concept of things being different, you know. So instead of stamping people with like a proper stamp when they get into the conference, we actually cut out LRL with a potato and stamped people with a potato when they came in. And then, but this,
I love it.
But this group of lunatics arrived. Literally, actual lunatics arrived to like listen to the show, and some of them were completely bonkers. I mean, you know, and there was people that ended had T-shirts on with the show like written on it, and one guy arrived with like a quote written on the front of the T-shirt and from the show. It was a lot of fun. And the thing that was nice was that it was just nice meeting like-minded lunatics. And
so sounds great. It really does.
Yeah,
because the ones that aren't like-minded, very scary.
No, those are the scary ones.
I'll tell you one thing that was one of the funniest things that I'll always remember was one thing we wanted to do in Lug Radio Live was to have like an hour of 5-minute talks. I'd seen this at Euro OSCON, and so I was talking to a guy, one of the other presenters, Ack, one night, and I said to Ack, I was like, I really like the idea of having a series of 5-minute talks. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. I said to him, well, actually, when I was at OSCON, Euro OSCON, Simon Willison, who's this quite well-known web developer, I said, Simon Willison was there, and he chaired the talks. He had a very small little gong, and he hit the gong after every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, why don't we do that? I said, yeah, good idea. And I'm like, my mind started ticking over more and more and more in the interest of trying to find something more ludicrous. And so I don't know if you got these over in the US, but in England, in the 70s, they made these old Rank movies. And the beginning, there's this enormous gong, and this guy like covered in baby oil with tiny little pants on.
That very well.
And he smacks it, and I was like, we need to do that. We need to have Simon Willison on the stage in a song, baby oiled up.
Oh, that's hysterical.
And we
Did
called
you do
it the...
It?
Well, so Ack said, Simon Willison's online right now, I'll ask him. And he said, you know, do you fancy doing it? Explain it. And Simon Willison was like, yeah, right, then that sounds fun. Ack went to bed, and I pinged Simon Willison. I said, look, Simon, I just wanted to say thanks for being such a good sport. And he said, oh, I thought he was joking. And his girlfriend disallowed him from doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, so we got another guy who called Adam Sweet, who would later become a presenter on the show. And it was called Adam Sweet's Gongathon Lightbulb Talk Extravaganza. And and basically, Adam went out and we bought him these tiny little underpants with tassels that were leopard skin hanging down.
Oh dear!
And it was what we did is we had him like we had a robe on, and so it's called Adam Sweet. And we had Sweet written on the back of the robe, and he was way at the back of the venue, and so we put on the Rocky music before he came out, and you had this dun 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 dun, dun, dun. And then Adam Sweet comes running out, throws the robe off, and it was when he was running out to the front. I was just stood next to Ack, and I just said to Ack, "I was like, I cannot believe this is actually happening." Yeah, so Lug Radio Live was just full of stuff like that, and
it sounds wonderful. I do want you to bring it back.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous, but a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a part of that story.
We're going to start the show with a big gong from now on.
That's a very gong.
I'm inspired.
I'm not getting oiled up, Leo, no matter what.
All right. Well,
we tried for future gongathons. We wanted to pick somebody like who was pretty well known, and we asked, you know, we did it at Lug Radio Live in San Francisco last year, and we asked Jeremy Allison. He said no.
Yeah. No, he said no. That guy's pretty game. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Well, we were surprised. We asked Chris DeBona from Google. He said no. And but then we got this guy called Aaron Bockover who maintains Banshee, and he's a very, very short guy.
Was the guy in the Rank films.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
Exactly. Well, Aaron Bockover started sticking like toilet tissue down the front because he felt a bit kind of, you know. And he came literally running through the venue screaming to get into the stage. It was a combination of great and disturbing at the same time.
John, I could see why you are such a rock star in the industry. People, you're just hysterical, and we've done such a great job. I cannot wait till the book comes out. I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, great.
And people can participate, artofcommunityonline.org.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Welcome people's input.
Yeah. And of course, if you want to know more about Ubuntu, it's ubuntu.com, ubuntu.com. Mm-hmm. But I think anybody listening probably is already running it.
I'd like to think so.
I would hope.
A lot of our audience, sure. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. This is great because we're like flossing with bacon today.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know about that.
I think that's probably not advisable.
we'll let you get back to is it CollabNet? We'll let you.
Oh, it's the Collab Summit, yeah.
Collab Summit, yeah. But thank you for joining us, Jono. Great.
Well, thanks
to talk
so much,
to you.
Guys. It was great chatting to you, bye.
Oh man, what a conversation! What a
I can see why people love him. I mean, he's just a hoot.
It's a lot of fun, and we didn't actually bring this up during the show, but just before the show, Jono and I have been talking about the fact that he's been off podcasting for a while. He sort of wants to get back into it,
but
only a little bit. So we're actually talking about, you know, this isn't firm yet, but actually taking like maybe 1 week out of every 8 from this sequence in Floss Weekly and actually do Flossing with Bacon every 8 weeks or so.
I am so up with that. Because that would be great.
We would cover Linux world, Linux activities, and not you know, breaking news, but like the most important things that happened in that 2 month sequence. And maybe I'd even tape it offline with him and keep our Wednesdays for you and me, and we would have like an extra insert show.
So you better not. You better put it on this network live and in person.
No. As an extra bonus.
If you're gonna have fun with Jono, I wanna be around for that.
All right, cool.
All right, anyway. If you can't, if I'm not around, you can do it without me.
But I'm thinking Flossing with Bacon could be like Flossing with Bacon Flossing with Bacon number two, and just have a an as time permits schedule. But we talked and he actually pushed it up to monthly, and I said no, I've got a long list of people I still got to get to on this show, so it's a little rough to try to add more to that list. But
we'll figure it out. If Jono, yeah. You know, the other thing is he could just join us on a show, and there you know eventually you're going to go back to the cruise schedule. You haven't been cruising a lot lately, but.
Yeah, he could be a guest host in place.
He could always fill in for you.
Yeah.
Anyway, he I just had a blast talking to him. He's a lot of fun.
I knew this was going to be a great show.
A lot of
fun. Fun guy. I enjoyed meeting him in person when I met him down there, and he's just been great online since then. And he's actually been on my Ustream feed a couple of times when I was doing my karaoke stuff. So that's pretty cool. He showed up one day. Hey, it's Jono. I went, oh, cool. You're watching me do karaoke. Great.
That is so neat.
It's very cool.
Did he sing with you?
No, it's a little hard. He was watching on the Ustream.
Oh, he's watching.
Yeah, the Ustream wasn't bi-directional for that, though. Yeah. So since I did bring up upcoming guests, because we are talking about having a huge schedule of people coming up in the future.
Yeah, it turns out there are a lot of people in open source. Who knew?
Really? In fact, I'm up to like 170 lines on my spreadsheet now.
We've got now 3 years, more than 3 years worth of shows.
Unless we go to Floss Daily, man.
I mean, when I have to. I really have to.
So a new one just added to the schedule. I think it's going to appear like in a couple of weeks. I'm going to get the final stuff down. But I've been talking with Brian Barry, who is the director of the OLE Nepal. I forget what OLE stands for, Open Learning Initiative or something like that. But he's in Nepal, and he is in charge of handing out, distributing, coordinating the 4,500 or so open one laptop per child XOs.
Wow, that's
so
great.
He's been working with the government there, the NGOs there, to really coordinate all that. And he's been pestering me for the last few weeks to get on the show. So I'm going to be doing an interview with him. I believe we'll also have, I've misplaced his name, sorry, the guy from Austria who's doing the same equivalent in Austria. And together they run olpcnews.org or something like that. So here he's coming up real soon. I'm going to get an interview with him. That may actually be the record for the furthest away we interviewed somebody. So Nepal, it's 12 time zones away. It's going to be sort of interesting.
That's funny because, boy, that's really weird. Because Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, is going to Nepal to do some photography with the Arrest of Everest crew. And he wants to do his show from Nepal. And I had just looked earlier today, like an hour ago,
at
the time zones. So that's just a weird coincidence.
Maybe they'll bump into each other. Maybe Nepal
I do know that's a it's a quite a big difference. It's almost it's 11-hour difference. So.
Yeah, actually it's 11:45 or
it's 11:45. Isn't that weird?
It's some weird number. Yeah, off a little ways. So we got him coming up on the short list. We've got Ian Pratt, who is runs ZenSource, the company, which is in charge of Zen, the virtualization software. that generates virtualization. So basically, this is something that Amazon uses for EC2, and Google uses it for their app engine and a bunch of other places to basically turn real hardware into virtual hardware. He's agreed to be on the show. We still got the guys coming up from Cinelera, the open source video editing software. So we're going to talk to them. And like I mentioned in the opening of the show, we've got Christopher Hall, who is with the OpenMoco project. But OpenMoco, the hardware, has disappeared as of this taping. So we're trying to figure out what's going to happen with that. Maybe we'll talk to them. And
well, there's still the software base, right?
Yeah, so. Still software base. So we're talking about that. We've also got, just recently added to the schedule, we've got, I'm going to mangle this name, but Mershad Mansouri of Bug Labs. So this is the more hardware, more open source hardware, with all sorts of good stuff happening with that. So those are all on the short list. So stay tuned, guys. There's some really great shows coming up. Yep.
Well, this has been a blast. Randall Schwartz at Stonehenge.com. And we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.